You'll recall that this morning we saw one of the definitions of the noun massacre is, or the verb is to kill indiscriminately, to make a general slaughter or carnage of, and of the noun also occasionally the wholesale killing of animals. Steve Ruskin is going to address that aspect of massacre. Steve is a native of Colorado Springs. He received a PhD in history and philosophy of science from the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of the book John Herschel's Cape Voyage, Private Science, Public Imagination, and the Ambitions of Empire, and numerous articles on the history of science, including most recently Advancing Astronomy on the American Frontier, the Career of Frank Herbert Loud, in the Journal of Astronomical History and Heritage. Steve.
Thanks. Yeah. After all, here we are at the end of the day talking about, I'm coming at the tail end of a number of very serious talks, and I think some of them were, well, all of them were really incredible. This session before lunch was just extremely powerful. So here I am talking about, even with a little pun up there, or at least a play on words, and thinking, is this really appropriate? So please understand that I take very seriously the theme of this talk, which is the, or this symposium, which has been the massacre of humans killing other humans, and now I'm making little jokes. So I say with tongue in cheek, going forward, that I'm going to present a massacre, the total body count of which far surpasses the cumulative body count of all the other talks that we've been talking about today, with the exception of, I think, one possibly coming after in the talking about the bison. And that's because I'm talking about a massacre mostly foul, the specimen collections of Charles Aiken and Edward Warren. Now, who were these two villains? Aiken and Warren were both local naturalists. Charles Aiken was an ornithologist, that is, someone who mostly studied birds. He was born in 1850, moved to Colorado Springs in 1871. It's probably fair to say that he was here a little bit before Colorado Springs, but Colorado Springs was not founded until 1871. And then he and his family moved into town, his parents. But he grew up in Chicago, where he learned taxidermy. He was sort of self-taught. He never got beyond high school education. And he was not a professional ornithologist in the sense of having a museum career, or he didn't work at any universities. His father had been had run a department store. In fact, there's an interesting connection between him and Marshall Field that I mentioned in the paper that they will eventually be publishing either online or in book form, that all of these talks will be coming on. But make a long story short, he grew up in a sort of retail-oriented family, and he ran a department store, that is, Charles Aiken ran a department store here in Colorado Springs called Aiken's Music Store, or Aiken's Music Store and Museum. It was around for about 50 years, and so some of you may have been familiar or may have heard of it before. And in his store, he sold music instruments, he sold sewing machines, he also sold stuffed birds and animals, and had a taxidermy and furrier shop in the back. And so that's how his passion was local birds, Rocky Mountain birds, and especially Colorado birds, but he made his living by running his department store, which had various locations too. It was on Pikes Peak Avenue for a while, it was on Tejon for a while, but ran more or less consistently for 50 years. Our other villain, if we must, is Edward Warren. He's pretty much 10 years behind Aiken in many things. He was born 10 years later, came to Colorado Springs 10 years later in 1881. He did have a college education. Actually, he went to MIT, but moved to Colorado Springs in 1881 with his family, and trained at Colorado College, actually, to be a surveyor and assayer for mining companies, and that's how he spent the next 20 or so years working in the mountains of Colorado, various places, Crested Butte, Irwin, Cripple Creek, and he was really fascinated with a number of local mammals, in particular the beavers and marmots, which he really thought were cool, and he wrote an authoritative book on Colorado beavers. But he was a mammalogist, although Aiken liked mammals too, and Warren was interested in birds, certainly. Warren focused on mammals and Aiken on birds. So these are our two naturalists. So I'm going to talk about their collecting and killing of specimens, their preparing, that is taxidermy of specimens, and their displaying of specimens, many of which still exist, most of which actually. First of all, collecting and killing. What was the naturalist's life like when they were out in the field? Well, they certainly needed specific tools for capturing animals, many of which they were killing either instantly or soon after they were trapped, but they used guns, rifles, shotguns, and pistols, obviously for mammals and larger birds. They could, you know, you could shoot smaller birds, but if they're too small and you're shooting them with a shotgun, you're just going to end up with an unfortunate puff of feathers and not much else. Nets, primarily for birds, and that's something Charles Aiken was quite good with, climbing up into trees and capturing birds and baby birds and things like that. And then traps, particularly for smaller mammals, and Edward Warren used those quite effectively too. So one thing I should mention is, if I haven't already, the final body count I will not reveal until the end of the talk. And it's a little different than what's been printed in the flyer too. So it's something you can all anticipate on tenterhooks in the edges of your seat, right? Aiken was a particularly good shot. He had a rifle and shotgun since he was a you know, teenager, which was, of course, wasn't uncommon, 12, 13, 14. I've read a number of his field diaries, and they're available in the Pioneers Museum and elsewhere up in Boulder. But Aiken is constantly referring back to his .32-20 revolver and all the kills he made with it, and he would shoot many things with it, larger birds like eagles. I once read an account where he shot an eagle just as it was taking flight out by Prospect Lake, and he said east of town near Prospect Lake. Of course, now Prospect Lake is smack in the middle of town, but he shoots this eagle kind of from a hip draw, you know, just as it's taking off a post or a tree. I think he was impressed with that. But the most interesting one, and the reason why I put this up here, and here's an example of a .32-20, or at least from a Colt catalog in the 1930s, but it's called the Frontier Army model, and this it says it's been around for 50 years, so Aiken's accounts here of the eagles and coyotes are from the 1880s and 1870s, even in the 1890s, so this is something similar to the gun he would have been using, but I'm reading through these field notes that he left behind. And, you know, he's not bragging because I think they're just his own private notes. Naturalists would record where they made their kills, what day, whether or not they got a male or a female, what kind of species. Because all of that, you know, for naturalists, the species distribution, where you found your species, was important to record. So he's not boasting. He's not writing into the Gazette. But I'm reading through blah, 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 eagle, coyote, ptarmigan, et cetera, wild turkey. And he says, on this one day it said, hit a running coyote through the heart with my .32-20 at 400 yards. And I had to read that a couple times, make sure it wasn't 40 with a little, you know, extra line there. It's 400 yards. And that actually stuck with me for a long time. And I thought, a .32-20, I mean, it's not a big caliber pistol. I mean, any pistol at 400 yards, you know, that's pretty impressive for a six shooter. This bothered me enough that I got on the web and found an antique gun site where some experts would, you know, talk about antique guns that they were interested in, and found someone who had written authoritatively on the .32-20, and I emailed him and said, you know, I'm Steve Ruskin, here's what I'm looking into, explained, you know, what I read, and I said, is this even possible? And he wrote back with a long and somewhat technical explanation, which I really appreciated, but long and short of it was, yes, it's possible, but it was, you know, there was a lot of luck involved, but it is possible. And he basically, you know, we sort of chat, we email back and forth, you know, the conditions would have to have been right. I mean, obviously, Aiken is an expert marksman. That was established. He was probably high up on a rise, or at least not, this would have been east of town. So there's plateaus and mesas out there. He would have been probably higher than the coyote that was running, and the wind probably would have had to have been right and all those sorts of things. But this antique gun expert concluded by saying, it was funny and I thought it was apt, he said that Charles Aiken was probably just as surprised as the coyote that he made that shot. It was, you know, it was the very, very definition of a long shot. So, but I bring that, you know, these are the interesting stories, these are the stories that make history interesting and give us a sense of, you know, what the naturalist life was like. Here's a picture of Warren. He's obviously a little bit older. Again, Warren didn't start his naturalist career until well into the 1890s and first part of the 20th century. But here's a great picture of a naturalist in the field. Good, I've got a pointer here. This is Warren out in the field. He's got his table set up. You can see what I assume is a beaver, possibly a marmot, hide up here. He's got his notebooks for recording his kills and probably some identification guides and other things. And you don't see his tents and supplies and guns, but this is, I think, this is a great image I found in the Pioneers Museum, Starsmore Center, showing Warren out in the field. And Aiken would have had something like this. Aiken would go on, when he was younger, he went on months-long collecting trips where he would come back with thousands of specimens. He didn't do that quite so much because he was running a store, but he would go out, you know, Aiken and Warren could just hop on the trolley or on the Denver and Rio Grande and go out for an afternoon of collecting if they wanted to. So they were very fortunate around here. You know, fortunate for, not for the birds and mammals, but for them. So, but you know, in later years, they would maybe go out for a week or two at a time. Sometimes, like I said, just for an afternoon. Interesting about Charles Aiken, another unique thing that he did, he was such a well-respected collector, even in his 20s, that Spencer Baird, who was the director of the National Museum back then, now we tend to call it the Smithsonian, knew of Aiken. He had such a good reputation that in 1875, as Baird was preparing for the 1876 Centennial Exhibition, which was held in Philadelphia, begged Aiken to get him as many good specimen samples of Rocky Mountain birds and mammals as he could, in particular buffalo and bear and mountain lion and bighorn sheep. So, but buffalo was really important for Baird, so Aiken got him a couple species, but he sent him this skeleton, and it is still on display in the Smithsonian in the Osteology Hall. This is a picture from a few years ago, but it was on their website. They let me use it, but I asked someone if they could confirm that it's still standing, and they walked down to the Osteology Hall and said, yep, it's still there. In fact, Aiken, I think if you can search their online catalogs, and I think he's got 160 or so specimens to his name that he's provided to the Smithsonian. So I think that's kind of neat. You know, a local naturalist was so well regarded that he provided one of the, a skeleton of one of the most definitive North American mammals to our National Museum. So I think that's kind of neat. So they were both, Aiken and Warren were both expert taxidermists. Here's an 1894 woodcut of what a bird taxidermist workshop would have looked like. The only difference, I think, for a mammal taxidermist would be that the tools and implements were much bigger. And I can show you an example of that in a second, but you can see the wire there to the lower left for stuffing and mounting the birds, some mounted birds up top, and a selection of rather macabre-looking tools there on the bench. They looked something like this. This is from the Edwin Carter Museum up in Breckenridge. If you haven't seen that, it's pretty neat, and I think it's free now. Most of their museums are, but Edwin Carter was a contemporary taxidermist. Many of his specimens formed the basis for the Denver Museum, well, the Colorado Natural History Museum, which is now the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. So you can see some rather wicked-looking tools here, and Carter was really good at buffalo and bear and that sort of thing also, so you needed these big knives and saws. They would also use some rather nasty chemicals, ammonia, potash, lye. Those were all used to tan hides. And arsenic was used very regularly by taxidermists to keep the specimens preserved. It was a preservative because it killed everything, including many taxidermists. Edwin Carter died of arsenic poisoning because arsenic in its pure form is less toxic, but it's also harder to apply. If you mix it with soap, you just rub the soap everywhere, but it's also extremely toxic. It gets into your skin. And Edwin Carter died after rubbing a whole bunch of arsenical soap into a bison hide and then slept in the same cabin, and you know, that was it. Aiken and Warren, I think, used the more pure version of arsenic, and they lived to a ripe old age, and I think they were somewhat preserved as well. But arsenic's important because it really worked as a preservative, and here's a fine example. You can go down to the Pioneers Museum today and see this beaver that Charles Aiken did. Other than the fact that it doesn't move, it looks pretty lifelike, and I think you can thank the arsenic for that. This is on the second floor. Interestingly, the Pioneers Museum does have a number of Aiken's birds, which of course he's more famous for, but because he used so much arsenic on them, they are wrapped up in plastic and stored safely off-site. I hope they don't do the same for this beaver. Now I want to talk about displaying. So they've killed their specimens, they've collected them, they've prepared them for display. Many specimens were not actually, made into lifelike poses. They were just called skins, where they were bones and insides were taken out. They were stuffed with cotton or something and then kept aside for scientific study. But really good samples, really good specimens were put on display, you know, in sort of lifelike poses, wings spread for birds and, you know, teeth eating beavers with their teeth digging into wood and that sort of thing. So, but Aiken and Warren, both local naturalists, in 1904, of course, General Palmer, who is a great patron of so many things locally, but also a patron of the sciences, which isn't really known as well. I'm trying to correct that. But in 1904, of course, Palmer Hall, named after General Palmer, was built. The center of Palmer Hall was a giant 150 foot by 50 foot museum, natural history museum. And you got a space that big, you need to start filling it with collections. So Stratton provided a fairly big one. We've got Scott Stratton, but Palmer also in 1907 spent a good chunk of money and purchased all of Aiken's collection. I'll give you a hint. He purchased 5,000 birds from Aiken. So that's kind of a hint towards the final total body count. And then, of course, 1909, Palmer died, and Aiken had a commitment to then provide a number of more specimens in the coming decades. But 1909, Palmer died, and Warren that year took over as the director of the museum. Till about 1918, and during that time, Warren also incorporated much of his own mammal collection into the Colorado College Museum. So the Colorado College Museum had both of their collections, and here's just one example of a case. I think it's, you know, mostly birds, and a lot of those will be Aikens. They never, obviously, an ostrich or an emu is not native to Colorado, but there are specimens from all over. So anyway, by 1918, it's safe to say that most of Aiken and Warren's collections were part of the Colorado College Museum. In the 1920s, Warren would sort of help out a little bit. The museum, of course, sort of fell into, it just wasn't utilized. Natural history sort of was a science that fell out to the wayside, and most of this stuff was put into storage. Eventually, in 1970, Aiken and Warren's collections went to the Natural History Museum up in Boulder at the University of Colorado up there, where they're still there, because they were, in many ways, the definitive collections of Colorado birds and mammals. Aiken and Warren were highly regarded for the work that they did in preserving Colorado species, many of which, well, not, I shouldn't say many, but some of which are extinct, and the only examples of which we have are due to their collections. So the next slides I'm gonna show are examples of their work, which are now housed up at the University of Colorado Natural History Museum. I was able to go up there earlier this year, and they gave me fairly free access. I mean, the curator was with me, but they let me look at pretty much whatever I wanted to. Interestingly, because I know the Pioneers Museum has most of Aiken's stuff stored safely away because it's covered in arsenic. These are all covered in arsenic. We're just using like cotton gloves. So I asked the curator, I said, are you worried about the arsenic at all? And you know, we're surrounded, I mean, it's a rooms this big full of drawers of dead animals. She just looked at me and kind of went, eh. I said, okay. I was only there for a good couple hours. She's there 8 hours a day, every day. Anyway, so here's an Arkansas flycatcher that Aiken collected in 1921, and he mounted a certain selection of really nice species just for display. And here is a western wood peewee that Aiken collected in 1927, and you can see, even though Palmer, of course, had long since passed away, it was all part of the Aiken collection of Colorado birds given to Colorado College by General William Jackson Palmer, William J. Palmer. And now Aiken, I'm gonna conclude with a few slides, because Aiken and Warren, again, so highly regarded for the work that they did, they had a number of species named after them, in part, some because they discovered them and some just because it was, you know, an honor for the work that they did. Here's the white-winged junco, Junco Hymalis aikeni. You can see Aiken's name appended here. And a lot of these tags actually have Aiken's handwriting still on them. Again, these are all just stuffed away in drawers. Arsenic fumes. Actually, arsenic doesn't really fume that badly, but these are all, and it gets a little worse, actually. Here's the western screech owl, which was also known as the Aiken screech owl. And this was very rare for a while. I mean, only Aiken had seen these for, you know, there was a time when, other than the specimens Aiken provided, no one had really seen them too often. The Colorado cottontail rabbit, in Warren's honor. And then a subspecies of what Warren thought was a subspecies of the yellow-bellied marmet that he discovered up by Irwin and Crested Butte. turns out to have not actually been a proper subspecies. But for a time, it was a more reddish color. They thought it was a subspecies, was given Warren's name as well. So in the minute I have left, the minute you've all been waiting for, who's counting the total body count just of their own official collections that are housed up in Boulder? 6,200 from Aiken, 3,500 from Warren, for a total of almost 10,000, 9,700. But I should point out that I know Aiken, in particular, spent so many years as a specimen dealer, selling specimens, trading them, that my guess is he alone probably accounted for another 5,000, maybe 10,000 that were just, you know, he didn't keep as part of his collection but sold on. Because obviously he's got 15 white-winged juncos, 20, you know, Western Wood Peewees, all kinds of different things. So anyway, it was a massacre, mostly fowl indeed.
We've now reached the home stretch. Okay. Some of you who were with us last year will remember that there was a bit of an experiment with a new form of getting down and dirty and fast called Pecha Kucha. We're going to try that again this year. I don't know if it's back by popular demand, but it's back. So we're going to have three presenters. We're going to have Robin Hammett, Jim Nelson, and Dave Mason, and I'm going to introduce all three because one of the purposes here is that nobody gets to breathe for 21 minutes, okay? This is Robin. Robin has resided in Colorado Springs for over 40 years. His paternal grandmother, father, and mother were all Colorado natives. His mother instilled an interest in history that was fanned at Palmer High School by one of his history teachers, Harry Smith. His interest in history has been reawakened through researching his own genealogy and assisting with the restoration of the 1905 Carnegie Building at the Pikes Peak Library District, leading to a return to school to seek a history degree. He is currently a part-time student at Pikes Peak Community College. He's a PPLD employee, having worked for 26 years in the facilities department. Get lost here. Jim Nelson, who's sitting over here, is a Utah native who earned a BS in civil engineering from the U.S. Coast Guard Academy and attended Johns Hopkins University while studying toward an MS in environmental engineering. He is certified as a professional engineer and currently is a supervisor in the facilities department of the Pikes Peak Library District. And as Tim mentioned earlier, our last presenter will be David Mason. He earned a BA from Colorado College and an MA and PhD from the University of Rochester. His award-winning collections of poetry include The Buried Houses, winner of the Nicholas Roerich Poetry Prize, The Country I Remember, winner of the Alice Faye de Castagnola Award, Arrivals, and the verse novel Ludlow, awarded Colorado Book Award for Poetry and named Best Book of Poetry in 2007 by the Contemporary Poet Review and the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum. Using blank verse, Ludlow tells the story of the 1914 Ludlow Massacre, in which miners and their families, as we've heard, were killed by the Colorado National Guard. He teaches at Colorado College and was appointed the Colorado Poet Laureate in 2010. I'll turn it over to Robin. One, two, three, go.
My subject is this Massacre of the American Bison. When Cortez first saw the bison, he saw it amongst Montezuma's menagerie, and the early descriptions of the bison came up with this drawing that was first published in Europe in 1552. One of Coronado's followers, Castaneda, said, "The first time we encountered the buffalo, all the horses took flight on seeing them, and they were a horrible sight." The quantities of buffalo were incredible. We find first comments about from the Lewis and Clark expedition that they were just so enormous they couldn't even calculate the number. And then Colonel Dodge, who did a lot of later counts of buffaloes or bison, the whole country appeared as though it was one great mass of buffalo. During this period, the estimates were as high as 100 million. Some of the herds were said to be ranged from 25 by 25 miles to upwards of 40 miles long. If you can imagine cresting Monument Hill and passing through a herd of bison and not leaving that herd until you hit Castle Rock. That's about 23 miles. So that's about how big some of these herds were. The estimates were as high as 100 million. There are estimates lower. It's really hard to say. They were going on calculations, of course, as Kathy alluded to earlier, historians aren't really good at math, so they had to calculate the geography of how much space a buffalo took while it was moving in these time frames. So it was all based on, but it was not uncommon to see them that big. The range of bison was over one-third of the North American continent. They ranged in the early days, but pre-colonial times, from almost the Atlantic tidal basin all the way to the Rocky Mountains, from Mexico to Canada. They took the whole center of the country. At the end of the colonial period, about the time of the Lewis Clark expedition, there were very few buffalo west or east of the Mississippi. So, but tens of thousands along the Great Plains. Here's some early images of what people saw. The American Indian hunted buffalo, and they used the, or bison. The term is somewhat interchangeable, although technically it should be bison. They hunted buffalo for food, clothing, shelter, bedding, and everything. They sustained the Native Americans. Later military officials would call the bison the grocery store of the American West for the bison, for the American Indians. As the Transcontinental Railroad got done in the 1860s, America expanded westward. So the bison would get in the way of the trains. There was talk about bison actually knocking trains off the track because as they tried to go through these herds, bison just nothing got in their way. They'd bump the train and sometimes knocked them off and derailed cars on the trains. The building of the Union Pacific really began the beginning of the Great Slaughter. Hordes of ruthless hide hunters would come and just shoot the buffalo and they'd skin them and leave the carcasses to rot just so they could sell the carcasses. The skins. They would get about a dollar a skin. The more and more there would be excursions out to just freelance and kill the buffalo just for the fun of it, just to get a little bit of easy target practice. The tongues of the buffalo became really popular as a delicacy back east, so they would eventually start harvesting the tongues out of the buffalo, the skin, and still leave the carcass to rot. Harper's Weekly published this they were just slaughtered for the hide. This was in the Harper's Weekly in December 1847. To get the hides, hunters would, because they would actually feed off the buffalo to sustain themselves. In 1872, one hide counted for 3 dead buffaloes. In 1873, one hide counted for 2 dead buffalo. And by 1874, they'd perfected themselves a little bit more that 100 hides would only account for 125 buffalo dead. But in 1878, we have this picture of 40,000 hides at a railhead waiting to be shipped back east and turned into buffalo robes. And here's a picture, it's a 1910 postcard, but very stylish, I'd say. Buffalo robes were kind of interesting. Early on, there were some protests. This is an early protest picture of the wanton destruction of the buffalo. It shows 2,000 a day for the Indians to get whiskey, 100,000 a day for robes, just for the fun of it. And I can't read that one. And just for the, just for the excitement, and this one is, so early on, there were already protests in the early days. William Hornaday was a big advocate of the buffalo, and he came up with this map in 1889. And this shows the buffalo range. You can see the red lines where they are as far east as they're, and getting down to these smaller areas, these small dots are about where the buffalo were in 1889. You can see how small their range got cut down. This is William Hornaday's count on January 1st, 1889. Only 25 in the Panhandle of Texas, 20 in Colorado, in southern Wyoming there were 26, 10 in Montana, 4 in Dakota, and the total number in the United States, 85, and 550 in the Northwest Territory, only 635 in North America, and that was the free-ranging bison. There were approximately 556 purebred in captivity and 200 on Yellowstone and 40 mixed breeds, accounting for only a little over 1,000 buffalo left in the United States on January 1st, 1889. Here's the body count. After they left the bodies to rot and the bones to bleach, they would collect the bones and they would send them to railheads, and bones would be ground up into fertilizer or ground up and then burned into bone ash to use for bone china. And as we were talking about body counts, that's just about all skulls. That entire stack, if you look at it very carefully, it's all skulls of buffaloes. So the background on this is what William Hornaday found is that the primary cause of the buffalo extermination, and the one that really kind of most people embrace, is its western expansion. We had to get all those herds of buffalo out of your way to be able to expand the country. But there are some secondary reasons. Man's reckless greed and wanton destructiveness. The wanton greed to get those, to sell those hides to make money. No protective measures for the buffalo or bison, that there were nothing in place to protect the bison. The fatal preference on the part of hunters, just both red and white, for the robe. The flesh of the cow was actually more preferred, and the robes from the cows were more preferred over the bulls. I'm not sure why. I guess they were a little bit, you know, softer. I don't know. And the perfection of modern breech-loading rifles and other sporting firearms made him much easier to kill. In 1905, Teddy Roosevelt, who established Yellowstone National Park, and William Hornaday established the American Bison Society. And the American Bison Society's mission was to work in a broad range of partners to build specific scientific and social basis to achieve ecological restoration of the North American bison. Currently, there are approximately 150,000 bison in the United States. Of those, only about 5,000 or so are free-ranging bison, but they're in protective reserves such as Yellowstone and the Bison Reserve in Montana. Many bison are raised strictly for meat, strictly as cattle, as livestock, and there are some in private herds. So I don't know, do the math, you know, approximately as many as 100 million bison we pretty much almost killed. 100 bison mostly in one decade from, or two decades from 1871 to 1889. So thank you.
During the mid-1800s, the world was changing dramatically. In that day's terminology, change was like a steam locomotive charging down the track. Over a period of only a few decades, several significant things happened that would profoundly change American lives. The discovery of gold in California started in the 49 California Gold Rush. A new religion was formed in the 1830s. Mormonism, or the Church of Latter-day Saints, was repeatedly moved, finally finding its permanent residence in the West at Salt Lake City in present-day Utah in 1847. The Pony Express was established in 1860, allowing mail to be moved across the country in a matter of days. In 1861, the telegraph system surpassed the Pony Express, moving messages across the country in minutes. And from 1863 through 1869, the Transcontinental Railway was built, significantly decreasing the time it took for people and goods to be to travel across the country. Each of these dramatic changes meant something was removed or changed. The Native Americans were losing control of great areas of geography. A civil war brewed over the practice of slavery. Food and other goods were being delivered to the expanding population in California, overloading the transportation system. Each of these major events had a focus on or a path through the Great Basin, containing what we call the Great Salt Lake. Around the world, massacres have often been associated with major economic, ideological, technological, and political changes, such as those just described. This logic brings us to today's topic. There are many massacres of humans in the Old West, and I believe that most of them were due to issues relating to war or race. Commonly, they were performed by or against either Native Americans or the government's military forces. The Mountain Meadows Massacre in southern Utah, carried out by a militia of Mormon settlers known as the Nauvoo Legion, was the largest non-war massacre where the killers and the killed were both of the same race. The Mormon Church was started by Joseph Smith in the 1830s in western New York. During the 1830s, the church was pushed from Ohio to Missouri and then to Illinois, where the founder, Joseph Smith, was assassinated in 1844. After being driven out of Illinois in 1847 because of their practice of polygamy, the Mormons settled at present-day Salt Lake City in the Great Basin. After settling in the Great Basin, the Mormons suffered devastating attack of grasshoppers and two droughts in 1855 and 56. They were becoming very destitute as a population, and they even considered departing that area as well. During the mid-1850s, investor Christopher Francher was planning his third trip to take cattle to California to sell. He and many relatives, along with other immigrants, departed Arkansas with their investment in cattle, horses, and gold. They traveled the standard trails with their entire families in wagon trains, typically pulled by strong oxen. The group took about 1,000 cattle, 100 special horses, and gold worth thousands of dollars. To put this in perspective, the typical income in 1860 for a farmer was $150 per year. That made the opportunity to gain thousands of dollars in income on the transport of livestock a very enticing one. During 1857, these two stories came together in this way. The Fancher wagon train chose the northern route to California. Traveling a dozen miles a day, they crossed the Great Plains and went north through what is now Wyoming. They planned to obtain respite and restock their supplies at Salt Lake City, as most wagon trains did at that time. However, the Mormons would not do business with them in Utah and pushed them on. When the wagon train reached southern Utah, just before crossing the Great Desert, the Fancher party stopped in Mountain Meadows, a high-altitude valley that contained water and feed for their livestock. After the immigrant party got to Mountain Meadows, they were attacked by what appeared to be a party of southern Paiute Indians, but was later identified primarily as a Mormon militia. The party circled their wagons to protect themselves and fired back. After 5 days, local Mormons, led by flags of peace, negotiated to escort the travelers away from the scene of the apparent Indian attack. The proposed plan required them to surrender their firearms and for the healthy men to be separated from the women and children. Having been pinned there for days and running low on water, food, and supplies, the immigrants agreed. Lacking other options, the Fancher party followed the Mormons' directions. The Mormons led two groups away from the circled train, shot and killed all of them, except some of the young children. 120 people were killed by the Mormons on September 11, 1857. Subsequently, the attackers took the clothes off the dead bodies. Local Mormons kept the small children to raise them and took the cattle, horses, and gold as their own. The bodies were left unburied for the next travelers following the trail to see. At that time, the U.S. government already had troops on their way to Utah. 2 years later, the children were sent back to Arkansas to be raised by relatives, and the remains of the bodies were buried by the government. 20 years after the event, a trial was held, resulting in a local Mormon leader, John D. Lee, being executed. The Mormon Church did not officially take responsibility for the massacre, in spite of their strict organizational command structure that indicates some leaders planned and implemented the incident. Ultimately, we do not know the motives of the killers or the experiences of those who were killed, but maybe, based on our actual knowledge, one would hope that this kind of massacre could be prevented in the future. The sad reality is that on the same date, 144 years later, another religious group used the current transcontinental transportation system to kill many wealthy investors, resulting in government-sponsored military action and execution of a religious leader. The more our world changes, the more it seems to stay the same.
Well, Ludlow is a novel in verse, and as a novel, what it needs to do is deal with historical material from the ground up. I need to give you a sense of the reality of the lives of the people I'm writing about. So one of my two main characters is a little girl named Louisa Mole. She's orphaned in chapter one of the book. They call her La Huérfana. And I want to read you a little bit from her point of view not long after she's orphaned, where this is set in the mining camp at Ludlow, or near Ludlow, a little bit before the strike, and this is when the immigrants are trying to decide what to do with this little girl whose father's just been killed in the mines. Out of the rock folds, the scrub, the deep sky. Out of the junipers that loosed the dark when the sun crept over the mountaintops. Out of the mouths and tipples of the mines where men still worked, inquest or no inquest, where coke ovens glowed a stone inferno. Out of the train that wailed to Trinidad and back to Denver with its load of news came the sound that was not a sound, a muted scratching for life. All day she watched the hens of mining families cluck about the houses, name them by the way they worried or bossed. One was Mrs. for her Scottish talent, catching bugs on the ground. One, Senora, for the way she pushed the other hens about despite a tattered wing Coyote plucked. And the old cock who croaked his song at sunrise was a Welshman for the way he tried to sing. Her playthings, better for not being people and being so much smaller when they died. Girls came by, showed her their stitched dolls. Boys looked over their shoulders, whispered among themselves. She heard them talking, breezes, hens, women. Whenever she passed the yards, their wash tubs, their bodies at work. "She knows," said Mrs. "She knows the rag, the blood. She's no too young for it. We've men who'd stoop to the wrong thing here. She isn't safe." And more she wouldn't hear, though it came at her in whispers from all sides in the feeding and breeding and dying life of the camp. She watched as a woman scooped up a hen by the legs, stepped on its squawking head, and jerked. Now, what I'm trying to do there is give some sense of the inwardness of a girl in a state of grief who can't really even look up at the adult world. The end of the same chapter, a middle-class family is adopting her, taking her away closer to Trinidad. And I want to read the final four stanzas of the chapter so you get a sense of how it closes on Louisa Mole. She saw the man who drove, his straw hat shading half his face. She saw two tall Macintosh on foot beside the wagon, talking to the man. The straw hat nodding, coat and tie, though it was hot. Her future coming close. The enemy, or so she used to think. A man of scrip and heavy prices, cursed by mining folk, a stranger, Mr. Reed. Louisa, too tall, stooped to touch her hair. Lass, this man's your new employer. Chin up, let's look at you. She saw the man's good shoes when he stepped down, the trousers, buttoned vest. George Reed, said Mr. Reed. Don't be afraid. He swung his hat off, a man of 30 years with blue eyes and a blonde mustache, his hair parted almost down the middle. That's it. Good girl. His mustache bristled when he smiled. She's not much older than mine. You say she can read? She's had it hard, said Too Tall. There's plenty around here's had it hard, said Mr. Reed. But we could use the help if she can work. You can work, can't you, young lady? Louisa, right? Louisa, you can work, can't you? Louisa nodded. That a girl. Good girl. They loaded up her apple crates of clothing, Bible, the wooden santo her mother brought from a village far away, the carver's name made shiny by the rub of hands. Abuelo. No tiene uno ni madre, said a voice behind her. Good lass, good lassie. Work hard and don't forget us, said Mrs. Goodbye, said the house, the hens, the risen dust. And now I'll read you a short section from the point of view of one of the historical characters. This is Louis Tikas, who was martyred at the Ludlow Massacre, April 20th, 1914. He had just become an American citizen. He was shot in the back by the Colorado militia in the course of what we call the Ludlow Massacre. This is a passage from Louis' point of view. His real name was Elias Bandidakis. He grew up in Crete. I know the house and the village he grew up in Crete. I knew that I could write this book when I learned about Louis, and because I speak Greek, I knew that I could write about the lives of Greek immigrants. So this is during the strike in the Ludlow camp, Louis Tikas awake with his lover beside him, and I'll just read this section from a chapter. Tikas, awake, surprised to feel such grief, tasted the salt of tears that came in dreams, and knew what he had missed was almost freedom. Years ago in sunlight when he drank the virgin pressing of the oil like wine at his father's house. Oh God, he missed the sea, the tears of an eternity of men, the peacefulness of swimming underwater. He missed the smell of grass and autumn rain, the sacks of dripping goat cheese hung from rafters, the words like thalassa and uranos that felt to him much weightier than English. Words in American were cardboard words, cast-offs of language naming nothing real. Something was wrong here, something very wrong, with a people who could never sing for joy. Beside him, breathing deeply, her pale breasts melted into his ribs, but pulsing faintly, the nurse, Pearl Jolly, who again crept in darkness and who made love with a joy he had seldom known, fidgeted in dreams, and he could almost feel her sailing in sleep to territories he could not imagine, spice islands of ambition, loss, and love. He knew her being here was dangerous, and it would have to stop. But what good was the little power he had if women were not drawn into his tent? And after all, the ancient Greeks would say, our life is short, and we should take such joy because the end of life is utter dark. And then he heard objections from the priest. But just as he prepared apologies, Pearl started, blinked her eyes, or seemed to peel her body off from his. They nodded to each other, shadow puppets in the play of searchlights over canvas walls. A last kiss, and she groped for underthings. She'd arrived uncorseted, and swiftly closed herself in clothes and slipped into the night. Somewhere a barking dog, and later footsteps. But since the militia came, no pot shots were fired above the tents by drunken guards. It seemed a lull, like January days in Greece, halcyon days, when calm and sunny seas could make you think the winter passed. But always storms returned, thrashing the olive trees, roiling heaven. So his mind went, as the wet touch of a woman grew fainter in the memory of skin. He felt the rash of kisses on his chin and knew that she'd be rasped and reddened too, because he had not shaved that day. The dark and her husband's drunkenness would save her from discovery. He touched her in his mind, afloat in freedoms he had never known. So the object there is not just to tell the story of the Ludlow Massacre, but to give it the ground sense of the individual lives of the people I'm writing about, and to make you to feel the reality and texture of the world in which this terrible event took place.
While they're coming up, I want to, on behalf of all the speakers, thank Dennis Daly, who's hiding over in the corner there. We send our PowerPoints to him, and he just seems to pull it all out of the sky. And flawless, and believe me, if you can do something flawless on the computer, you got some smarts, okay? Let's open it up for questions. Yes, sir.
Jim, the Mount Meadow Massacre, the lead of perpetrator they end up convicting, my memory served me that he was executed at the site.
Question on the Mountain Massacres executed at the site. Jim, you want to?
Yes, I believe so. I saw some pictures in one of the books that showed drawings of him being executed at the Mountain Meadows site. It was about 20 years later.
You don't know if the judge decided that or a jury or where, why there as opposed to back in Salt Lake?
No, I'm not sure the details on that. I know it was interesting reading what he had to say, and he wrote just before his execution, talking about the church ordered him to do it and that that it wasn't just him doing it.
Yes, ma'am, in the back.
How might one identify a bona fide avian bird specimen?
How might one? Okay, how might one identify an Aiken bird without touching the arsenic? Is that what you wanted to know?
Do you mean a specimen that he collected or just
is it? If one has such a bird specimen, how might one tell if it's a bird bonafide?
The short answer is all their specimens, any good naturalist would attach a label to their specimen, whatever kind of animal it was. Who collected it, Aiken, Warren, whomever, where they found it, whether it was male or female, their best attempt at identification if it wasn't clear. And that's why, like, for example, you saw some of the Aiken white-winged junco, each one had four or five tags on it, right? Those labels were added as the specimens moved from one collection to another or that sort of thing. But so anyway, the short answer is it would be on the label. And if it didn't have a label, there would probably be no way to tell.
Yes, sir.
On the discussion of the Columbine Massacre and the Columbine school shooting, it was stated that 80% of school shooters had asked for help. They said they might have been turned in. And you would think if you took care of 80%, you have pretty well cured. How about the non-school shooters, the general population? How many of those people say they would do the same thing because they're going to distort the success rate?
Okay, the question is a comparison of school shooters that are part of the school population versus school shooters from outside the general population. And Heather, can you address that?
Well, the 80% that the author was pulling from was from the report from the Secret Service and Department of Education, saying that 80% in some way had talked about committing the act. It doesn't say anything regarding non-school shooters, so I don't know the specific statistic on that.
Yes, sir.
Steve Rockman. I'm interested in if there were any, the relationship between Warren and Aiken, did they have any collaborations, and did either of them have any connection with Martha Maxwell?
Did Warren and Aiken collaborate, and did they have any relationship with Martha Maxwell?
Aiken and Warren did collaborate. Warren was, again, 10 years younger than Aiken, so he sort of looked to Aiken as sort of a senior naturalist who he respected, even though you know, Warren went to MIT and Aiken really had no education beyond high school, but Aiken had such a good reputation nationally. They did go on one trip together when they were a lot older through down towards Canyon City where the Aiken family ranch. Aiken returned to the Springs and Warren continued on his collecting trip. But Aiken was kind of a quiet, he tended to keep to himself from what I can tell. Warren was a lot more gregarious. So Aiken was a bit reserved, let's put it that way. I think Warren would probably have liked to have spent more time with him, but he didn't. Did they know Martha Maxwell? My guess is probably yes, probably Warren, but I don't know for sure.
And Steve, who's Martha Maxwell?
She was another important naturalist and taxidermist in Colorado. She collected a number of Colorado specimens. Also, I think many of them ended up in the Denver Natural History Museum up there. And many of her specimens were also on display in some of the bigger exhibitions, like the Columbian one in Chicago, I believe. So,
as long as you're there, I'd like to ask,
okay,
did anybody ever say to these two guys, that's not very nice?
you know,
mean, when did we stop massacring large numbers of...
I'm just as excited for the book, or at least the online papers. We hope they'll do a book, but no pressure, guys. So our longer versions of all our papers can come out. But the Audubon movement, short version, the Audubon movement of the 1890s really made shooting birds, even for scientific purposes, kind of taboo, or you know, just not acceptable. And Aiken responded to that well. I think he certainly collected more birds, but he also, and I talk about this in my paper, he gave a talk to 600 students at Colorado College one morning in 1898, where he had a lot of his specimens out there, a good 500, almost one specimen for each student to look at. But he also said, you know, that you don't kill birds just for the sake of killing birds. You kill just what you need to collect for scientific reasons, and I don't think he always did that, but that's what he told them. And you don't, and you leave the rest alive. So.
Okay, I see Tim standing over here, who's going to tell us about the rest of the festivities today. Thank you to our speakers, and thank you to the audience. Enjoyable.